Facing challenges and overcoming setbacks is part of doing business. Whether you have the expertise to survive them or not could mean the difference between success or failure. Welcome to We Are Women, featuring revealing conversations that provide invaluable insights into the success secrets of female masterminds. A must listen for every entrepreneurial woman. Now here's your host, Janine Vosper.
Hi, it's Janine Vosper. Welcome to this episode of the We Are Women podcast. All the way from Rhode Island, I have Nicolai Blinnow. She is a licensed mental health counsellor and life coach specialising in burnout, highly functioning anxiety, and adult ADHD. Prior to her becoming a therapist, Nicolai was in a job that she liked well enough, but it left her frequently feeling unfulfilled and burnt out. So some of the listeners, you might already start to be able to relate to this. She became a certified yoga instructor, started understanding the impacts of stress on the body, and began providing meaningful tools to stressed out professionals before pursuing her master's degree in mental health counselling. She now owns and operates her private coaching and mental health practice, where she integrates her training in mindfulness and holistic living with her clinical training in behavioural science. Her ultimate goal is to help neurodiverse entrepreneurs and executives find balance in the high burnout world, which is modern American society, and you can relate that just across to any society. I was going to say Western, but it's not, is it? It's just this.
Yeah, I think it's most of society at this point.
Absolutely. Her TEDx talk, Yoga and Its Connection to Mental Health, has over 300,000 views. Woohoo, well done you. And is evidence of Nicolai's belief in integrating holistic and scientific principles so people can feel truly experience the helpful aspects of both worlds. Welcome, Nicolai.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I've run through that introduction a couple of times, which we've deleted off the front of this. Each time I've read through, I'm going, this is really great, because I love the idea of connecting what people might call woo-woo or spiritual side or mindfulness, the mental health side, and then the spirit and the physical as well. I think it needs to be combined.
Yeah, and thank you for using the word woo-woo. I use that word all the time with my finger quotes. And I think actually in my TED Talk, I use it as well. I'm a big fan of integrating holistic principles with, you know, evidence-based behavioral science. And way back when I was in graduate school, which feels like forever ago now, I feel like I was an outlier in that I was like the yoga teacher, woo-woo lady who decided to pursue her master's degree in mental health. And so often they were telling me, yoga is not therapy. But I'm happy to share that now trauma-informed yoga is a thing, and people like Bessel van der Kolk are studying the impact of trauma on the body and using a lot of mindfulness principles. So it's lovely to see how far it's come, but there were times where I felt like quite the outsider for a bit there, because it was just people weren't doing it.
No. Actually, a good friend of mine is a physiotherapist. She's been doing that for about 30 years, but she now does mental health physiotherapy, and they have conventions around the world, and it's a very big deal. So it's such an important combination, and realizing that we are one. It's not, we're not separate components.
Yeah, and I think we sometimes try to separate things because it feels maybe more straightforward that way. I had one of my clients literally say to me last week, I think what I've learned and what I still sometimes have to remember is I can't just rationalize myself out of my stress. Sometimes the stress I'm feeling is actually very real in my body. And this is someone I actually also referred to a naturopathic physician that I collaborate with. And they were saying, you know, just understanding that stress is literally felt in my body just as much as it is felt in the worries that are in my brain.
Yeah, and that's, and I'm very much with you. There's all, I have a naturopath who is also a kinesiologist, you know, the exercise, that all of the people that are in my life. And depending what's going on, I'm thinking, okay, who do I need to see? You know, who's the right fit for me at the moment? And it can be the naturopath. It's a different space because it's all components of what's going on and how to deal with it. So tell me more about you, though. You know, what were you doing, and then how did, because it's one thing to say, you know, I had burnout, but a lot of people either go through that experience and then can't get back on their feet again, or they just keep pushing through. So tell me about you.
Yeah, so I shared at the beginning of the recording, I don't know if it will end up on the segment, but my dad is an immigrant from Eastern Europe. And I think that's an important part of my burnout story, because basically, you know, living in America where one parent is a first generation American, or on that side, I'm actually the first generation born here, there was a lot of bearing witness to hustling very hard and working very hard to succeed, because my father's family had come over with nothing basically after World War II and had to rebuild. So I think I internalized from an early age that working hard is something to be admired. And I do believe that is true, because I look at my grandparents who were very hard workers and achieved quite high levels of success as the result of that, and really desiring stability. So somewhere along the way, when I was growing up, I just wanted to have a job that, you know, was going to give me lovely health care, because in the States we don't have universal health care. And, you know, a decent paycheck while still connecting with my value system. So my first career, I ended up working in higher education, and I was more on the business side of higher education, where I worked in fundraising and in alumni relations. And I think that's relevant is because, you know, I thought I did everything right in terms of blending something I believed in. I'm a first generation college student in my family on both sides. Neither of my parents had gone to college. So I thought, okay, I'll get a job in a field that I believe in that also gives me the stability that I really value based on watching my parents' experiences, and everything will be okay. But what I learned is that subconscious sort of programming that I had to be a naturally hard worker, part of, I think, the reason why I ended up being burnt out. And honestly, it wasn't a one-time thing for me. I think it was more of a pattern of sort of reoccurrence, is because I had this sort of subconscious belief system that was informing me, that made it hard for me to slow down and take things off my plate. I think I became a bit of a natural workaholic. And I also mentioned in my bio that I work with people who have ADHD, and I am a 41-year-old woman who works in mental health and has for the past 11 years, and basically self-diagnosed myself with ADHD within the past few years, which I think is an experience a lot of women are having, and especially women in leadership, women who are very successful, because when we have ADHD, it can manifest differently in women, but also differently in high achievers. Like, I never had problems with grades. I always got great grades. I actually graduated high school getting a lot of awards and recognition. Every job I ever had before I made my career change, I moved up pretty quickly, and people seemed to enjoy working with me and thought I was good at my job. So I think that's part of my burnout story too, is when you have ADHD, there's different forms of it. And I'm what they would call a combined type person, which means my focus actually is quite good, but I have this internal restlessness where relaxing is genuinely hard for me. So take someone from an immigrant background who grew up, you know, watching people work really hard, who has a natural inner restlessness, and then put them in a job where working in fundraising is a very money-dominated field, very finance focused field, which I think is a field that is also more likely to burn you out than some other fields, because when it's money, people don't mess around.
Yes.
And it was like ripe for
that burnt it out. Sounds like that there's just layer upon layer upon layer there. And just even your definition of that combined ADHD, I'm thinking, yeah, that sounds about right. Stay focused on anything, but I've got 400 screens open and I can just open one, close it off, or go, oh, that's right, I need to be there, go into it, go back out of it without any dent in what I was actually doing. It's yes. And I do have a son that was diagnosed in primary school with ADHD. But yes, it does manifest very differently in him, the loss of focus or one task at a time doing it well. And yes, it's quite a different space. So interesting. What I'm hearing, though, from what you're saying, and I think a lot of people could probably relate to it, is the word obligation. So this sense of obligation to family, obligation to succeed, obligation to go to college, because it's very different in Australia with college and university. They're pushing a lot more with university here now. We don't have that interim, that college. You just go to from high school into uni, and then your degree base then. But they're pushing a lot more of that now. But in the States, if you don't go to college, you're a bit of a failure, aren't you?
For a long time, I think now we're seeing a shift. It's interesting. So I'm married. And my husband is a tradesman. He is an electrician. And we joked for quite a while at the beginning of my career that he was able to learn a trade, and he earned very, very good money with very, very little student debt. Because I don't know how it is in Australia, but here we're pretty much self-funding our education. We can apply for some scholarship and financial aid and things. But my husband was earning very good money with very little debt in a very short period of time compared to me with my fancy. I have 2 degrees. I have an undergraduate degree and then a master's level degree, and had to take a big fancy exam to get the degree, and I have to answer to a board. But even then, at the beginning, he was doing quite well. So I think there are some people in the States who are choosing other paths. And I think, yeah, a lot of times we're conditioned to believe that, like, this is the path we should be taking.
Yes, my sons and husband and family, father and everyone, they're all in trades and they're all doing extremely well. So it's quite a different space. But the it's that sense of obligation, and I can see that with someone who might be neurodivergent. It becomes more intense, doesn't it? It's that, especially because a lot of people may notice something about who they are, but they'll deal with it on the side and just keep moving forward, especially if they're a type A personality as well, that they're trying to push through.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of I think a lot of neurodivergent people specifically, at least the sort of high achieving people that I tend to work with who are in leadership, I think somewhere early in life, there's two things that happen. I think neurodivergent people tend to be often more aware and actually more sort of emotionally attuned than neurotypical people. And so we just feel things more deeply and can see things often that other people around us honestly cannot see. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of neurodivergent people unintentionally become a bit of people pleasers and perfectionists as a result, because if we can just make everybody feel good and we can achieve whatever standards have been set for us, then we don't have to feel anyone else's stress, right? If the world around us is calm, then we are calm. And I think a lot of super high functioning neurodivergent people, there's some point early in life where they felt a little different. They realize that they're different. And that's where the term masking comes into, you know, the clinical world. Okay. You feel different. And at the end of the day, I think, especially when you're young, everyone just wants to fit in when they're younger. Mm-hmm. So you just become, I think, a perfectionist or very obligation focused, because that also just is how sometimes we receive praise and affirmation back from people. And if we're neurodivergent, it gives us a good dopamine hit, which is something our brains are naturally lacking. So when you put an obligation in front of us and we fulfill that obligation, our brains get a little bit of a reward, but also we get an environmental reward, I think, too. And then that just happens over and over and over again in life. And then all of a sudden you're in your 20s or 30s or 40s or maybe even 50s, and you're looking around going like, why am I doing this? Or how did this happen?
Because you're repeating, you're doing something and you then get the reward from it. As you said, the dopamine hit, mm-hmm. and you do it again and it rewards, and you do it again and it rewards. So mm-hmm. you've actually rewired the brain to go, this is the what I need to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think maybe not for every person, but certainly for, you know, the high achievers, and again, and especially if we're neurodivergent high achievers, I can speak for myself. My dopamine hits were, you know, getting good grades and just performing well. You know, mm-hmm. if you put me in front of a task or a school assignment, I was the one who I wanted to get the best grade. In third grade, I actually have a memory of a student teacher, I don't want to say yelling at me, but saying, can you please stop raising your hands? Because we need other kids to be able to answer the question. But that's how eager I was.
Yes. And that's, I mean, that's a whole nother discussion. By saying that to an 8-year-old,
a young person.
Mm-hmm. There's a book I read recently, I think it's called Blink, and it's that instant mm-hmm. moment that all of a sudden I won't raise my hand. You know, it's
exactly.
I work with a client who, this was horrendous, in grade one, she was a chatterbox. She was talking all the time mm-hmm. in class. So the teacher got her out the front, pulled out her tongue, and threatened her with a pair of scissors on her tongue if she kept speaking. So she never spoke up in class again. She mm-hmm. ended up leaving school at 15 and not being able to read. She's now a kinesiologist. She's a speaker. She does a whole lot of other things as well and puts the message out there. Still takes a lot longer to read than other people. But that one moment affected her as to, you know, what the rest of her schooling was like. And even as an adult, being in relationships where other people did for her, and so she lost herself as well. It doesn't take much, does it? You know, it's...
Yeah, and I think it comes back to that mind-body connection. What happens in a moment in time like that is, you know, our little younger selves what we don't realize is happening. And if inside of our body, we're having a stress response and there's all these stress hormones that are getting flooded out when we have someone make a comment like that to us. And because all those stress hormones are flooding throughout our body, it actually affects how these memories of these moments are stored. And all of a sudden now it's like a subconscious programming that's been planted in our minds and we don't even realize it.
And it does affect people's lives. We talk about burnout for a lot, and we did that in the intro. We've talked about, what is it?
So burnout was, I think it was the year 2017, but don't quote me on the exact year, where the World Health Organization actually recognized burnout as a condition. And it used to be associated purely with workplace stress. However, depending on if you're looking into certain circles, like for example, Psychology Today, they will say burnout has now spread beyond workplace stress. You can suffer from parental burnout, which is parenting burnout. You can suffer from caregiving burnout, which I think a lot of people in middle age are having to deal with as they juggle raising young children with planning for parental caretaking. Even relationship burnout is a term that you hear. But to boil it down to its basics, being burnt out means that your stress system, your nervous system, has become chronically stressed and exhausted to the point that in order to be considered officially burnt out, you have to meet three criteria. And the first one is emotional exhaustion. The second criteria for being burnt out is basically feeling detached or removed. For some people, this might also be cynical, even more negative than normal. And then the third indicator of burnout is a decreased sense of productivity. So feeling like you're just not as productive as you used to be. And I think a footnote for that one is, I think a lot of women in positions of leadership and a lot of high functioning ADHD people, they actually still are doing a lot, but they're maybe not productive in the ways that they would like to be. So for example, I have a client who, is a C-suite executive, has no problem functioning at work, but has been talking about cleaning out her closet for forever, right? Certain tasks, you don't have, I think, the emotional energy to push through tasks that don't excite you.
Okay. Yeah, I get that sense of that with what you're saying. So is it more women that recognize burnout, or?
It depends, honestly, where you're looking at the research. There's a lot of people who will say that, yes, women are more likely to burn out because in our modern societies, a lot of women are still carrying a lot of the primary responsibility for home life if they are married or they're parenting. And so there's a lot more cognitive demand that women are carrying when they're in leadership positions and they're also raising children or taking care of a house or maintaining a marriage. I think, I don't know, our nervous systems also, I think, sometimes interpret things and experience things differently than men. However, there are some people will say that men are also vulnerable to burnout, maybe sometimes more depending on how we're slicing it, because in a lot of societies, men are still socialized to be very strong and so don't always seek the supports or ask for help the way that women may feel more comfortable doing, or seeking out someone like me, like a therapist or a coach. So they tend to white knuckle it for longer and maybe let it get worse. Maybe that's a way of interpreting it. So it's a tangential answer about, it just depends, I think, on what you're reading and from whom and how they're conceptualizing it. But I think, I don't know, my personal opinion, well, maybe we're all just burnt out as I'm hearing myself talk through it. I don't know.
So they would actually, men and women, it would represent differently too, I'm imagining.
Yeah. I think a lot of women who are burnt out are really just still looking really productive and trying to push through it. And on the outside, people may not even notice that they're burnt out. I had a client say to me recently, "Oh, when I reached out to you, I just would go to work and they're in a leadership role and I would come home and I literally just felt like a puddle." And I just thought, wow, that's such a good way to put it. But no one necessarily sees that you feel like a puddle. That's more of an internal experience. And because they're, you know, again, in a position of leadership where there, a lot of people are accountable to them. They're married. They have two older children. It's just pick yourself up by the bootstraps every day and just keep pushing through, and probably are running on adrenaline, which gets you through day to day, but also is why you just feel chronically tired, exhausted. One of my clients said, "I just feel like I have nothing left to give." And yet here they are still giving and having great output every day.
Yeah, so it's more internalized unless they actually go and speak to a therapist. And I, you know, from experience here in Australia, I think it's a worldwide thing, is men tend to, as you said, not necessarily share it until it becomes extreme, and then they take extreme measures.
Yeah, I have a good friend who is an engineer at a very well-known company. And I'll just say everyone is stressed out. I'm hearing a lot of anecdotal stories about the men who seem to be stressed out doing more of what we would call quiet quitting. Basically just literally checking out and doing the bare minimum of their jobs. And my friend, who is a female, is dealing with the repercussions of that and sometimes feeling frustrated by that. And that might be an anecdotal example sometimes of men perhaps don't speak up for how they're feeling, try to remain strong. When it gets to the point that it's bad enough, they're just checking out, or sometimes lashing out, I think, too.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. Or take
irritable,
or taking the final step.
Yes, yeah. Versus women, I think, are always trying to do better and thinking about what they can do. Just, you know, what's the right self-care practice? How can I change my mindset? I just need to think about it differently. And then I don't know.
Yeah.
It's how it goes.
So thinking about that, then how does that yoga, I mean, with your practice, is that something that you then include with how you work with your clients?
I think I don't necessarily do yoga with people, and that I'm not necessarily sitting here teaching them a yoga sequence, but I will always encourage them. My clinical orientation is in two things. One is a dialectical behavioral therapy, or DBT. And the other is eye movement desensitization or reprocessing, which is EMDR. Both of those practices basically highly, highly emphasize mindfulness as an important part of the practice. And I consider mindfulness to be a foundational part of healing, because what I teach people is that mindfulness, by definition, simply means being present without judgment, without avoiding or clinging to things. And when we can do that, oftentimes we reduce our suffering. We feel more in control of our mind instead of our mind being in control of us. And we can see reality more clearly. And so if we're going to solve the problem of burnout for each of us as individuals, I think mindfulness is one core practice that we have to have in place, because mindfulness, whether it's through yoga or through meditation or through another mindfulness practice, it helps connect us to our body, which helps us become more present. And then we can see more clearly what the patterns are that may be contributing. And often what I do see is when people don't feel their best, they just want to jump into problem solving and thinking about what can I do? What can I do? What's the answer? And sometimes you can waste an awful lot of time and energy trying to problem solve because you're not problem solving from a mindful place.
Yeah, it's more
and
of
so while it may not
problem solving, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And so while it may not be yoga, I'd say like mindfulness always to be more intentional problem solving versus reactive problem solving.
So you said a couple of things that DBT, what is that?
So DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, grew out of cognitive behavioral therapy. And cognitive behavioral therapy came into being in like the late 1960s, 1970s. And basically, cognitive behavioral therapy teaches us if we can change our cognitions, which is our thoughts. So if we can change our mindset and we can change our behavior, then we can feel better. And what they found is for some people that works perfectly and it's great. However, there are people and times where you run into situations where changing your mindset about it just isn't enough. For example, what if you're in a corporate job? I just had a client leave a leadership position because they realized that the particular field that they were in, and specifically the leadership board for the organization, just didn't align with my client's values.
Right.
That's a fact, and we can help you think differently about that. However, as much as we try and change your thought processes, you're still answering to a board that doesn't align with your values in a field that you don't feel particularly connected to or passionate about. So no amount of rethinking it is necessarily going to get you the space and the emotional freedom that you may crave.
And that's such an important factor with anything, isn't it? Is to, we can't just keep pushing through things if they don't align with our values, it because it becomes a juxtaposition of what you want to, what you should be doing, or you know, that should, that obligation, as opposed to what the body's going, no, this is not good for me, thank you very much, I'm out of here. And so they'll drop out, as you said, quiet quitting, maybe, you know, that might be just how somebody does it, or physically leave, or they push through and end up in a very stressful situation.
Yeah. And so basically, dialectical behavioral therapy came along and said, hey, it's not so simple. Ultimately, what we have to do is we have to find balance. It's all about finding balance and balancing when there are times where we need to accept things and when there are times when we need to change things. And there's probably an infinite myriad of ways that we might accept or change things depending on the individual person and the individual situation. So using the values, I have had clients in the past who, quite frankly, are in a role that doesn't necessarily align with their values, and they are perfectly fine with it because the role that they're in allows them to live within their values and other parts of their life.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense. If your family is your highest priority, then
exactly
you will stay in a position that can support your family, because so you go in and you do the job, and then you can be in that comfortable space supporting your family because that value is high.
Exactly. And so for some people, you know, having a job that doesn't align with your values isn't necessarily a deal breaker or something that will burn them out if they're aware of their broader value system and it's still connecting with that value system in some way. Whereas for other people, they might think about staying in a job that doesn't align with their values. And to them, that might feel torturous and impossible. And they might feel like they use energy every day just tolerating a job that doesn't resonate with them. And I think that's ultimately how DBT approaches things, is the nature of the world is it's dialectical. We're always trying to find out the gray areas in life. And so even when I'm working with my clients, it's about helping them figure out what they need, using, you know, the tools that I have to offer and my expertise, versus thinking that like there's one approach or a handful of approaches that people should just implement to feel better, which sometimes I think with cognitive behavioral therapy, some people have told me they feel like sometimes it's a little bit too black or white for them. And that's where it doesn't give them the outcomes that they're looking for.
No, I understand that. So now when you're working with ADHD and people of other neurodivergent qualities, then how does this all sort of tie in with that? Is it a different process, or is identifying that first? Because a lot of people wouldn't realize that that was part of who they are.
Yeah, I think basically what I do with my clients, what my role is ultimately really observing and assessing who my client is, right? So in DBT, we talk about what are some just really practical ways to be more mindful. And one of the skills we teach, which seems so simple, and yet we're pulled in so many directions, is just observe. Be more observant in life, internally. Observe your thoughts, your feelings, your reactions to things. Externally, right? Observe what's going on around you and how those things make you feel. And in DBT, we're trained basically to practice what we preach. So we use all of the same tools that we would teach our clients. My clients tell me, you know, they think I'm good at my job. And one of the things they often mention is I'm very good at calling people out from a non-judgmental way, because I'm basically sitting here getting to know you, watching you, listening to you, asking what your goals are, and then watching for what I think is getting in your way. And then based on my observation of you, offering then what I think are going to be solutions. Okay. And usually there's a handful of those. And so basically when I'm sitting with people, I'm basically studying them and thinking in my brain of all the interventions and strategies I know, and then providing them as needed to each individual. And with DBT, there's hundreds and hundreds of things. So sometimes I feel like a little living encyclopedia of like stuff in my head.
Yeah.
That just comes with like years of experience. And then with EMDR, I'm also listening for.
So what was it?
What are some of those? EMDR's eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. And that was originally developed for PTSD. Now you can use it with all sorts of things. But basically, the D in EMDR stands for desensitization. So with EMDR, we can help desensitize people to things that overwhelm them. So for example, I know you do like public speaking, right? So for example, maybe someone had something like I shared, the teacher in third grade who said, stop raising your hand, right? That could easily plant a seed for a fear of like being seen and putting yourself out there, which is an important part of public speaking, getting up on the podium or on the screen or in front of the conference room. But a memory like that could have planted a literal physiological response in your nervous system that now every time I have to go stand in front of a group of people, I'm getting anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so with EMDR, it's just processes we do to basically desensitize people to the stressors or targets. You can think of it as triggers for their anxiety. And reprocessing is helping your brain genuinely think differently about it. So for example, if I think, go ahead.
I remember when I was studying NLP, and so it was, there was components of that were, so my, addiction to sweet lollies, and one of them was the banana lollies. We have them here. They're just a sweet thing. And part of that was it became dried dog do instead of what it was, so that it was something then going, well, there's no way I'm putting that in my mouth anymore. Mm-hmm. It was, is that part of a desensitization type of thing? Or it seemed pretty extreme, but it worked.
Well, if it worked, then I'm happy to hear it. In EMDR, we more help people's brains come to their own more adaptive or helpful ways of thinking about it. So if I use your example of being addicted to sweets, I might ask a person, okay, and like, what does that mean about you if you can't prevent yourself from eating the banana lolly? And someone might say, I'm not in control. Like, I can't control myself. And so the goal would be to actually get that person's brain to genuinely believe basically what is the opposite of that. And it might be, I can only control what I can. And so, when you're ruminating on the banana lollies, if your brain is also saying, I'm not in control, I'm not in control, I'm not in control, even if you're not actively thinking that, but it's in your subconscious, it becomes this like inner fight with yourself, which is exhausting, which is going to make you much more likely to reach for the lollies because you're just exhausted. Versus if your brain naturally, when that trigger happens, your brain just believes, I can only control what I can, then the behavior that comes out of that might be, I'm not going to buy banana lollies and leave them in the house. And when I want something sweet, maybe I'm going to start keeping fruit and I'll just have fruit instead of lollipops. Like, you just start making different choices because we've genuinely helped you think differently about the stressor, but not in a way where we're making it bad. We're just making the way you think about it feel less overwhelming for you. And then the benefit there is where if we make your brain believe that the lollies just taste like poop, that helps you not eat the lollies, but that doesn't necessarily translate out into other things quite as well. Versus if your brain believes, well, I can only control what I can, or maybe just believes like I have self-control and I can make effective choices or whatever you want to believe, that's a belief that won't just show up with the lollies, but can potentially show up in other areas of your life where it could also be helpful.
I get the difference in that. And that was really a great definition and explaining that. So it's, and that's an important factor, isn't it? It's I can only control what I can. And I think that would help a lot of people avoid those, the burnout and the stress.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who are burnt out, whether they know it or not, have these internalized beliefs that they have to be in control. Or they like
just putting
being
my
in
hand
control.
Up for that. Okay.
Me too. Yeah, me too. A lot of them feel like they have to be perfect. That's another one I see a lot.
That's not me.
That one's not you.
No. Good. I do it well, and I do and good enough is just get it done.
Good. That's great. It makes life easier. And then sometimes even just not feeling safe in some way, whether it's physically safe or just emotionally safe. So sometimes being able to see what are these beliefs in your brain and just know what the opposite is. So a lot of my clients walk around, if they were doing, for example, a public speaking engagement, if we go back to that example, sometimes just saying, I'm safe now, is enough for the person who maybe gets that panic feeling before public speaking.
Yeah, that's handy in a whole lot of situations, Nikolai. We've covered an awful lot. If what three takeaway points do you, out of everything that we've discussed, do you want people to remember in particular?
Yeah, I would say burnout is more common than you think, and there's a likelihood that you may be struggling with burnout, even if you don't initially realize it, especially if you're a woman in leadership, because you're so used to pushing through. That would be number one. I would say number two is that there's a lot of different things that leave us vulnerable to burnout. You heard me talk about some of them today. I think ADHD and other types of neurodiversities are one vulnerability factor that makes you more likely to burn out. Some of these little traumas we're talking about, but basically conditioning from earlier in life that's programmed you to show up a certain way, is more likely to make you burn out. And because you're more likely to burn out than you realize, and there's a lot of contributing factors that make you vulnerable to burning out, that there's no one size fits all approach to treating burnout. You know, we came into this conversation at the very beginning talking about naturopathic medicine. Right. I would say naturopaths and holistic doctors potentially help burnout by really focusing on the level of the body specifically.
Yeah.
Right. Someone like me as a therapist, I work both in your subconscious, which is what are the patterns that you don't even realize that are being powered by beliefs that you may not even know that are there. But I'm also a behaviorist, so I understand how to change behavior. And so I'm coming at it both from sort of the mental subconscious place and a behavioral place. But, you know, then you could maybe have a hypnotist who might work also in subconscious programming, or, you know, I've had clients do acupuncture, regular massage therapy. There's a lot of different ways. And I think the takeaway is, I guess, trust your gut to guide you towards what you need, and know that sometimes because of that mind-body connection, you might need a few different strategies or a few different professional support networks.
Yes.
Right? Like,
understand.
For example, you might be able to help someone with coaching them through some of their fears around public speaking or helping improve that skill. There might be other things, who knows, hiding out in that person's subconscious that are getting in their way that you may not feel capable of understanding or tackling with them. And so sometimes I think people have to know that you might need a few people to support you in different ways.
And I think that's really smart to do that anyway, you know, is figure out. And I love that you said trust your gut too. You know, what you feel is works with you. And I imagine people will also possibly feel a bit too challenged and may pull back, and they're just not ready for it yet.
Yeah, which I think is why trusting your gut is number one, because I think your gut will tell you where you're ready to start. Right. So if, you know, a therapist or a coach is too scary because we might push you too much, then okay, start with maybe a naturopathic doctor, some acupuncture, go to a coach who specializes in something really specific that you know is going to help you, that feels like you're dipping your toes in the water. And then if you want to do deeper work, then you get to that eventually. Or, you know, if you've tried coaches and you're the person who you work with a coach and you do okay with that coach, but you're not really capable of following through consistently, you might need a therapist, because there might be some self-conscious sabotaging stuff that you don't even realize is happening that a therapist could help you figure out and overcome.
Excellent. Great advice. Nicola, how can people get in touch with you?
So best place is my website. It is ompowermentpsych.com. So it's ompowerment, like the word empowerment, but with an O. Psych, psych, like psychology.com. And if people want to go to ompowermentpsych.com/checklist, I actually have a free checklist for burnt out women in leadership, especially the neurodivergent ladies who want some strategies that they can start out with. And that's all free. So people can go there, or you can just jump to dropping me an email. It's just my first name, Nikolai, Nikolai, at ompowermentpsych.com. And I get emails from my TED Talk. That was years ago. And every now and then I still get people reaching out to me asking questions. So I'm always happy to receive an email and hear from people from
wherever. And we connect on LinkedIn as well. So you're on LinkedIn too.
Yes, and on LinkedIn as well. Thank you. So you're more organized than I am with my own materials.
And I've got everything in your show notes also. So people will be able to track you down. And I just want to thank you for sharing that. I've had quite a few guests come on, and from all different aspects of trauma and burnout and different spaces, but everyone has a different skill to offer. And this is what I love about it. It's people listening. It's finding the right person for them. And it just does make a difference as to who they can connect with or what would work best for them, particularly as we're talking about people with neurodivergent ADHD, and also that's burnout. We want people to be thriving and healthy and well, and just enjoying what they do in life. So thank you.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed hanging out with you today.
And that's another episode of the We Are Women podcast. I am Janine Vosper, your host. Remember to go to janinevosper.com and book a strategy call. If there's something that you need some assistance with, it may be something I can help with. But if not, I have got an amazing diary of women that I know I can recommend that you might want to speak to. So janinevosper.com. I look forward to you joining us next time on the We Are Women podcast, no matter where you are in the world. Bye-bye for now.
So, do you feel stuck in a rut in business? Visit speechperfect.com.au and download Janine's free ebook to avoid the 5 most common stumbling blocks women face in business. It's jam-packed full of tips to overcome the barriers that could be holding you back from the success that you dream your business will be. We would love you to leave a review of today's episode and share this podcast with other women in need of entrepreneurial inspiration. Subscribe to the next episode now and join the We Are Women community.